From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The U.S. Constitution was designed as an anti-corruption tool. That's the argument a George Mason University professor makes in the recent book, Republic of Virtue. You'll learn what he means. Speaking at a national conservative conference, a Raleigh entrepreneur touts the benefits of the recent federal tax reform. You'll hear why. Duke University recently hosted a scholar who explains why the original political progressives pursued some very illiberal goals. And we'll examine details of proposed legislation dubbed the Right to Earn a Living Act. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
When we're sick, we expect to call a doctor's office, make an appointment, and have timely access to quality medical care. Those of us on the patient side of this transaction never really question that a trained physician will be there to help us. Some healthcare analysts, however, are getting concerned that North Carolina is losing many of the doctors that train here. Catherine Restrepo is one of the analysts looking at the issue of graduate medical education. She, of course, the John Locke Foundation's Director of Healthcare Policy. Catherine, welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Are we in danger of not having enough doctors, nurses, mm-hmm. et cetera, in this state?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a great question. And last month, there was this whole subcommittee on graduate medical education, and it talked about that very issue. And people think, and I once thought that North Carolina had a shortage of physicians, but it's really a physician maldistribution area. So you don't have enough doctors practicing in less populated areas and rural areas, more practicing in urban metropolitan areas of the state.
If you live, for example, in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area, perhaps around the Triad, Winston-Salem-Greensboro, mm-hmm. and in Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill, you're probably not going to have a problem. Outside of those areas, however, could be an issue.
Yes, very much so an issue. I mean, people are traveling 2 to 3 hours just to see a specialist in Orange County where Chapel Hill is if they're out more in the rural western parts of the state. So this is an issue. And some of the researchers that came in who really they're experts in healthcare workforce data and trends and where people are located, where physicians are practicing across the state. You know, they really delved into, you know, how as taxpayers, since we're talking about graduate medical education, most graduate medical education is funded by taxpayers. So how can taxpayers get a better value for what we're paying? In other words, how can we bring doctors into more rural parts of the state?
Catherine, that's a fascinating thing you just said, because I can tell you I had no idea that we as taxpayers were helping to pay for the training of doctors. Mm-hmm. So I apologize for my ignorance on that, but do people even realize that?
No, I think a lot of people don't realize that. And in fact, Congress never really started appropriating money for graduate medical education. That is where physicians go for residency training and clinical education at hospitals after they complete medical school. This all really started happening after the World War II era. And for the most part, beforehand, hospitals paid for residency slots themselves. And actually, this funding was supposed to be temporary until
this is World War II.
Yes,
temporary.
Right? Yes, right. Yeah, it was supposed to be temporary. And the Veterans Health Administration, they also provide some graduate medical education funds, and so does other federal agencies as well.
So we're talking about federal money here.
Yes,
then, right?
For the most part, most graduate medical education money comes from Medicare. However, when we're talking about the subcommittees that were held last month, for state taxpayers to get better value for how we're spending these graduate medical education dollars, some of it also comes from Medicaid. And that's where we're looking at how taxpayers can get a better value at the state level, because that is jointly funded by the state and federal government.
How is it determined then? It almost sounds like, you know, is there some room where people are sitting down and saying, okay, this hospital is going to have this many slots and here's the money for that. Mm-hmm. And here's what we're going to train these people in. How does it actually work?
Yeah. Those are some of the details I still need to look into. But I mean, certain teaching hospitals, depending where you're located, get more funds than other hospitals. And so once there's more transparency in the process, this has actually sparked, you know, triggered legislators at the state level, you know, calling for reforms, you know, just having more transparency of where these funds are going, you know, is it equitably distributed? And in fact, is this money aligning with the healthcare workforce needs, you know, all these unmet patient needs?
In fact, you've written a lot about the fact that we have a primary care doctor maldistribution, I think is what you call it.
Yes.
It's a shortage in certain areas.
Yeah, I mean, 25 counties don't have an OBGYN. I mean, 14% of North Carolina's population is living in areas where there's, you know, not enough physicians per 10,000 people in those areas.
One would think that there would be some sort of distribution of funds to try to meet those particular needs. Is there a legitimate mm-hmm. role then for state policymakers to say, look, you know, you maybe need to be moving this money around a bit?
Absolutely. And there has been, I mean, it's not, some teaching hospitals are good at trying to align the graduate medical funds they get with workforce needs. So some are really adamant about creating more family medicine residency programs, community-based programs where doctors are trained out in rural areas. And, you know, based on their statistics, if a physician goes to medical school and completes their residency training in North Carolina, they're more likely to stay and practice in North Carolina. So it's sort of like when you're looking at that pipeline, you know, a lot of these experts are saying that it's a leaky pipeline because overall we only retain 40% of physicians. You know, so how can we keep more physicians in state and how can we incentivize them to practice in rural areas?
That's really curious. So you're saying that of every 10 physicians that are trained through these federal and state funds, four of them stay in North Carolina, but six mm-hmm. of them leave.
Yes. So overall, we are a net importer of physicians.
So mm-hmm. what do we do about that?
Well, I think there just, again, there needs to be way more transparency with how these funds are allocated, because right now it's hard to track the amount and where these funds are going because they're tied on to, I mean, these Medicare payments, it's embedded in Medicare payments with hospital claims. So when a hospital submits a claim, a GME or Medicare pays them, you know, an add-on percentage, and that equates to graduate medical education
this
funding,
so
and they can use that how they
it's
want
my
to.
My hair hurt just hearing yes. you describe it. And one can only imagine if you are, for example, a state legislator, or frankly, mm-hmm. you're a member of the U.S., the North Carolina congressional delegation, you've got to be scratching your head and
yes.
saying, how do we even begin
yes,
to figure
so,
this
so
out?
So it's funded through add-on payments and through intergovernmental transfers. So there's really not a lot of transparency here. But I think the best way is to just completely separate this into its own separate pool for funding, and then have states be more flexible and have more control over how to manage that funding, since so much of it comes from the federal government. It would be better for states to have more control over those dollars.
Catherine, how is it that this has become a subject of interest mm-hmm. and importance to state legislators?
Yes, well, this all goes back to that widening disparity of rural-urban health care. I mean, that's such a critical issue that lawmakers are focusing on right now. So it's not just graduate medical education of trying to, you know, provide incentives for physicians to locate in rural areas of the state where they are needed, but also looking at all these other policies where you can, you know, not – you can take away caps on supply for healthcare services and healthcare needs. I mean, looking at scope of practice reform, letting nurse practitioners practice where they want to without having to be tied to where a physician is, because they currently – if they want to treat patients, they have to – have this written contractual agreement with the physician. So in some cases, that sort of hinders where they may want to practice across the state for liability reasons, for sure.
Catherine, in our remaining moments here, how is the medical field reacting to this mm-hmm. Interest from policymakers? Are they welcoming this, or are they a little bit kind of pushing back?
I think you're definitely going to have people who like the way that it's currently been, because some hospitals, you know, if they specialize in certain services, you know, they can use that graduate medical education funding for their own interests rather than aligning it with what the patients actually really need across the state. So you have that sort of battle going on. But I think for the most part, there's this growing consensus that there needs to be a call for reform.
Catherine, the director of healthcare policy for the John Locke Foundation. Catherine, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Americans have debated the meaning of the United States Constitution for well over 200 years. Our next guest points to one particular goal of that document, the creation of an anti-corruption covenant. He explains what he means within the book, The Republic of Virtue, How We Tried to Ban Corruption, Failed, and What We Can Do About It. The author of that book is F.H. Frank Buckley, Foundation Professor at the Scalia Law School at George Mason University. Welcome back to the program.
Mitch, thanks. Good to be back.
So, why is the U.S. Constitution, in your view, an anti-corruption covenant?
Well, there are two stories. The first story is that whatever we might have thought about the British, we admired their Constitution, except for one thing. It was just a nest of corruption. I mean, the king was essentially bribing members of Parliament to vote his way. I would just accept it. So that's part of a story. Part of it is it's a matter of product differentiation. I mean, we like the Brits, but we don't like their corruption. And then the other part of it has to do with the story behind the way the convention worked. And we kind of have this feeling that, oh, it just had to work out that way, but it didn't. I mean, we nearly fell apart. I mean, there was nearly a walkout led, I think, by Madison. And then at one crucial point, one delegate got up and said, gentlemen, if you want an anti-corruption government, here's what we have to do. And the name of that fellow was Gouverneur Morris, and he's one of the untold heroes of the convention. And so what he persuaded people to do, which I think was the most momentous decision at the founding, was to have a structure for electing a president which turned out in the fullness of time to be popular election. And that was supposed to cure corruption. So that's how we got our Constitution, and that's how it was supposed to be an anti-corruption covenant.
So this was back in 1787 at the start of the process. As the subtitle of your book says, we tried to ban corruption, and then the second part is failed. How did it end up failing?
Well, I think a lot of people would agree we failed. I mean, I don't think that's terribly controversial. In fact, there are people who run studies of how corrupt is your country, and they interview local people, and we don't do terribly well. And, you know, and sometimes people say, well, golly, you know, we're America. How can that be? And I tell them, well, you ever heard of this place called Louisiana or Illinois? And they say, oh, okay. But I mean, chiefly, I think the problem is a Washington problem. I think chiefly the problem is the swamp. And there are a number of reasons for that. But one of them is the presidency. It's an all-powerful institution. And the checks and balances, which were supposed to prevent the president from being too powerful, failed and turned out to be a cloak with which he could hide his sins. And, you know, I think the obvious example was Obama's presidency and, you know, the IRS scandal, for example. He said it's not even a smidgen of evidence, and it all went away.
We are speaking with Frank Buckley, Foundation Professor at the Scalia Law School at George Mason University, also author of the book The Republic of Virtue, How We Tried to Ban Corruption, Failed, and What We Can Do About It. We're going to get to the What We Can Do About It coming up in just a bit. But are there elements of the Constitution, the original plan, that did work or are working that we ought to preserve?
Oh, well, yes. And the big one is federalism. I mean, the point about federalism is when power is chiefly located in the state government, if a state happens to be corrupt, you've got an exit option, right? I mean, if you don't like Illinois, you can move to Texas, or maybe even better still, North Carolina, right? So that tends to cure the problem. But the more the power is centralized in the feds, the harder it is to exercise that escape hatch. I mean, you can escape from Illinois, but not so easy to escape from Washington, you know. So restoring federalism would be a big answer to it. You know, that apart, there are some smaller things we could do, which I think would be really, really useful. But we're not going to, you know what? We're not going to absolutely ban corruption. I mean, the optimal level of corruption is not zero, because that would take a Robespierre to chop off some heads. We don't want that.
Yeah, you already got into this, but the last part of the prescription in the subtitle is what we can do about it. Restoring federalism is important. Are there other things we really need to look at?
Well, there are, and I mentioned two things. The first is kind of a negative thing. We have all these campaign finance laws, and the guys who talk about corruption typically are on the left, and they say, well, you know, the answer is get the scandal of money out of politics, by which mostly they mean let's get the scandal of Republican money out of politics. Right? Because, I mean, look, Hillary outspent Trump by, 50% last time around. So they know how to spend money. They've got tons of money. They have a good more money than we do. But that's fine. You know, more power to them. The problem with our campaign finance laws is they're like a net that has a curious feature that the big fish swim through and the small fish get caught. And the small fish often are people with inconvenient political views. So it's a good tool for persecuting your opponents. And in addition to all of that, when you have to disclose who your donors are, you unleash this, you know, at present you can unleash an internet mob where they post your name and your address and your kids and where you go jogging and all of that. I mean, it's an invitation to an assault. And of course, you've got these Antifa monsters out there who are only too happy to do that. So I would just junk all we have out there in terms of campaign finance laws. There are no limits on expenditures by virtue of the Supreme Court. I would get rid of contribution limits. They're basically eliminated for smart people with lawyers, and I'd let people do it anonymously. And what I do, and positively, is I'd concentrate on the lobbyists. There you can do something.
What about the lobbyists?
Well, you know, I'm here visiting North Carolina from the D.C. area. I'm right in the middle of the swamp, right? And the swamp is composed of a lot of, you know, smart, good old lawyers working in the district and influencing legislators. And in part, that's a good thing. I mean, they are educating people who often arrive in Congress not knowing, you know, what's going on. But at the same time, they shouldn't be able to give money to the congressmen. And outright gifts have been banned. But right now, congressmen can receive campaign finance contributions from lobbyists, and lobbyists can organize these meetings for congressmen. I get that part of the money out of it. You know, they have good intellectual resources, the lobbyists. Let them inform congressmen about what bills are all about. They're good at that. What they don't have to do is, you know, give them, monetary contributions.
How convinced are you that we can and will do something about this? Is this wishful thinking, or is it likely that we can actually accomplish something that will fix the system?
Well, I have high hopes. I don't want to predict the future in any way, shape, or form, but I think a lot of people have recognized that we had a real problem with corruption. And the election in 2016 was, I think, importantly, a referendum on that. I mean, whatever you might think about Trump, I think many of your listeners will have pretty clear ideas about what Hillary Clinton was all about. I mean, when you walk into politics and you end up making a ton of money, that sort of tells you something. So it was a moment where we rediscovered corruption, and Trump has had plans to drain the swamp, as he puts it. Well, you know, we're a year into it, and we're still waiting, and we'll see what's going to happen. I mean, I think the instincts were right. But, you know, there was this French guy, Charles Péguy, who had a line about this. He says, everything begins in mystique and ends in politics.
Well, you can learn much more about this topic by reading the book titled The Republic of Virtue, How We Tried to Ban Corruption, Failed, and What We Can Do About It. Its author is F.H. Buckley, Frank Buckley, a foundation professor at the Scalia Law School at George Mason University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch, for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. How big a deal is the recent federal tax cut? Raleigh entrepreneur Bob Luddy shared his thoughts during the recent National Conservative Political Action Conference.
The Trump corporate income tax cut is probably the most important economic tool that we could ever have in this country. It's going to energize entrepreneurs. So we're going to have more entrepreneurs. We're going to have more job creation, more technologies, and more investment, which increases productivity, higher GDP, and a much better country.
Luddy says tax rates could be even lower.
If you go back to Calvin Coolidge, 1925, taxes were reduced to 25%, and his biggest worry is that the government would collect too much money. So when taxes are low, people willingly pay the tax. When taxes are high, they try to avoid tax. One of the biggest problems for small businesses is just figuring out how to pay their taxes. So they have payroll taxes, and then in many cases, they have to pay their taxes before they've even collected the money. So taxes are a cost and are a major cost to small business, and are also a major cost in terms of time because they don't have that cash flow. So this is going to energize a whole range of small business people. And I might also comment that these small business people are training workers who don't have jobs, who need skills. So they're increasing the family, they're training workers, and many of them are going to vault to much higher careers over time.
What else could Congress do on taxes?
The main thing they could do is simplify, because taxes are extraordinarily complex. Again, if we have a simple tax code and a low relative tax, people are willing to pay the tax. It's not a burden to them. Our tax code is a conundrum, first class.
There has been some talk about raising the federal gas tax. Luddy doesn't like it.
I think it's a terrible idea. The swamp's got plenty of money. The more money we give them, the more trouble they cause, the more they regulate us, and the more they give it to their political buddies. So I say no more taxes.
Luddy says conservatives need to keep fighting against higher taxes.
Government is always short of money, so the idea that the government needs more money and we have to have more taxes is a terrible idea. I think we need to reinforce that when we have tax cuts, we put money in the hands of entrepreneurs. Those entrepreneurs are capital allocators, and they're the best capital allocators in this country. That's really the key message. That drives productivity, jobs, technologies, and our economy.
And Congress could learn lessons from North Carolina.
North Carolina's tax cuts work because we controlled spending. Our federal spending is totally out of control. We need to drive that message at these congressmen and senators every single day, because they have an addiction to spending. And if we don't solve it, interest rates are going to go sky high. You see evidence already.
That's Raleigh entrepreneur Bob Luddy speaking at the recent National Conservative Political Action Conference. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some people use the words liberal and progressive interchangeably, but that's a mistake, especially if you're talking about the original American progressives of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Princeton University research scholar Thomas Leonard tells their story in a book titled Illiberal Reformers. He discussed it recently at Duke University. One part of the story, economists became professionals.
When the economists turned pro, you have to remember laissez-faire is a really lousy strategy for professionalizing, right? How much expertise is required to repeat in every situation, let the market decide, right? Not too much expertise. So if you're an expert retailing ideas and policy that say politicians or judges can't understand, that's not a good strategy. So that when economists are professionalizing and trying to sell their services as experts to the state, they're making both an epistemic move on the one hand, where they're saying to politicians and to judges and to parties, we know something that you don't. They're also making a vocational move, which is that it's probably going to be good for business. I belabor this slightly because I want you to understand how audacious this move was in retrospect. Right. If you're going to establish an administrative government, sort of staffed and directed by scientific experts, you have to first transform economics. Second, you have to transform higher education. And third, you have to transform government, because none of these things exist, as I said, in 1880.
Early professional economists had no love for laissez-faire liberalism.
The progressives take their newfound authority as social scientists with expert knowledge. They turn them into rhetorical weapons, and they use that to convince Americans and their political leaders that laissez-faire is not only economically outmoded, it's also ethically wanting, right? They say that industrial capitalism creates conflict, it creates dislocation, it operates wastefully. This is a hugely important idea, that capitalism is inefficient as well as inhumane, and it distributes its copious fruits unjustly. Not only that, industrial capitalism has given us new organizational entities, things that simply really didn't exist before, like, say, natural monopolies, like, say, industrial corporations, like, say, industrial labor unions, right? So the idea here is that free markets, if they ever could, can no longer self-regulate. What we need, if we want progress, is the visible hand of a powerful administrative state guided by expert social scientists.
That's the voice of Thomas Leonard of Princeton, author of the book Illiberal Reformers, a recent speaker at Duke University. Leonard says these illiberal progressives pursued various goals.
What united them most, in the way we should think about them collectively, is an abiding faith in the visible hand of the administrative state as the best means for realizing their decidedly plural ends. There are labor reformers, there are immigration reformers, there are political reformers, there are prohibitionists, there are scientific charity workers. There are many motley and diverse programs, but they all agree that they can get what they want with an administrative state.
Leonard says progressives placed experts ahead of business and government leaders.
In the progressives' conception, the capitalist is grubbing profit, the politician is pursuing power, but the expert uniquely is selflessly pursuing the good of society, which he also uniquely can be trusted to identify and to serve. I would claim further that the establishment of the fourth branch of government also marks an epoch-making change in the relationship of government to American economic life. It also importantly shifts power within the state. It moves powers from American courts and American parties to the new independent agencies of the executive. Thus, it moves power from judges and from politicians to bureaucratic experts.
These so-called experts got some issues very wrong.
Progressives had some really admirable ideas along with some reprehensible ideas. And the thing to recognize is they advocated both kinds of ideas in the name of progress. In the late 19th century in the United States, a liberal was someone who was committed to individual freedom, a market economy, and strong protection of individual rights against the state. If you want a bumper sticker version, it would be free soil, free labor, and free trade. It was a short interval. Progressives saw this as laissez-faire, which was a pejorative term. They judged it to be unjust, inefficient, and outmoded, and they led a successful crusade to dismantle it. And when they remade American economic life with this new instrument of reform, they also simultaneously remade liberalism. That's why when you go to the Oxford English Dictionary and you look up the term liberal, you'll find one term that says liberal in the 19th century sense, supporting or advocating individual rights, civil liberties, and political and social reform, tending towards individual freedom with little state intervention. And then right above it, liberalism in the 20th century sense, favoring social reform and a lot of state intervention in matters of economic, right? There's two different definitions for the very same word.
Did progressives live up to their name? Leonard addressed that question.
The original progressives were not that progressive. Many of them, the intellectual leaders among them, certainly promoted scientific racism. They promoted eugenics. Eugenics is the social control of human heredity. Why was it that progressives in particular were attracted to eugenics? I'll give you four reasons that I think matter. The first is that eugenics is deeply anti-individualist, and so too was progressivism. Second, eugenics promised efficiency. Third, it required expertise. After all, you have to identify the fit and the unfit, ex ante. And four, it was scientific. And the raison d'etre of eugenics, certainly the progressive era version of it, is that racial health is just too important to be left unregulated.
Leonard suggests today's experts should learn lessons from what early progressives got wrong.
They actually thought they had it right, and they didn't. And they were the best and the brightest. You have to remember that people like Woodrow Wilson and Richard T. Ely and John R. Commons and Edward A. Ross are the most prominent public intellectuals of their day. We still have buildings and institutes. I sit in one. And prizes named for these men. And they were mostly all men. Still today, right? They were racist. They were eugenicist. They were sexist. They were elitist. And they used and abused their political and intellectual authority to promote these ideas. Now, we can say in retrospect that, by golly, they're wrong, and we won't make those same mistakes. I suggest we will. 100 years from now, we'll be making similar sorts of mistakes. I hope not so egregious. So be humble in your work.
That's Thomas Leonard, research fellow at Princeton University and author of the book Illiberal Reformers. He's urging caution to an audience of experts and future experts at Duke University. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. All she wanted to do was to open a makeup artistry school. But Charlotte resident Yasna Bukvich-Bayani didn't realize that she would have to battle the state of North Carolina to have the right to open her business. It is a battle that she has finally won, a battle that shines the light on a group of cumbersome regulations known as occupational licensing requirements. John Sanders is with the John Locke Foundation. He follows the fight to free North Carolinians from these outdated rules, joins us now. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna.
Why couldn't this Charlotte resident open up a makeup artistry school? What was the problem?
The problem was that the cosmetology board decided that they really wanted her to be able, they really wanted her to teach cosmetology and aesthetics instead of just makeup. And she just wanted to talk about makeup.
Okay, so forgive my ignorance, but what's the difference between makeup and aesthetics?
Well, aesthetics, as I understand it, involves such things as hair plucking and facials, and it gets into a whole greater array than just applying makeup.
So we had this licensing board that essentially told this woman, no, you have to do all these different things and you have to meet all the rules and requirements to do all these different things. But that's not what she wanted to do, John.
No, and it would have been a significant expense on her. And it, as it turned out, it would have been a prohibitive expense against her. I mean, her school would have had to spend more time, 5 to 1 in terms of hours, if I understand it correctly, teaching aesthetics over teaching makeup. And it would have required her to buy a lot of equipment, over $10,000 worth, and, of course, walk the line with the licensing board.
Well, when she discovered this, of course, she was dismayed by this and didn't think that this was right, that it was impeding her right to earn a living. She decided to really make this a battle. and went to court over this. This ended up in mediation. Tell us about this. What occurred and who were the parties involved here?
Well, she contacted the Institute for Justice, which represents people like her around the country and fighting government. And they sued and went to court.
Was it the state of North Carolina that they sued, this particular board?
Yes. Anyway, as you said, it went into mediation, and the right outcome was reached, I believe. I mean, they said, look, the First Amendment should not prohibit you from being able to speak about makeup. And so the state of North Carolina should not either.
So, John, people may not realize that this is just one example of a much larger picture, that there are many of these types of boards. And one of the great things about the work that you do here at the John Locke Foundation is you monitor a lot of these cases pretty regularly, and you write about them at johnlocke.org. In fact, you've been taking a look at what other states are doing to try to combat this, because North Carolina is not the only state that engages in this kind of prohibitive licensing requirements. Tell us about what other states are doing.
Right. North Carolina is one of the more prohibitive states in terms of occupational licensing. But in the last few years, really, I think it stems from another North Carolina case, one that went all the way to the Supreme Court, the Board of Dental Examiners that was a case where the dental board wanted to prevent people from opening teeth whitening kiosks and from day spas allowing teeth whitening services. They were selling for under $100 to less than $400, whereas dentists were able to charge $1,300 or so. The dental board lost, and the fallout from the case is several states, nine that I've counted so far, have started deregulating some of their licensing. Three of them, Arizona, Tennessee, and Mississippi, have passed a Right to Earn a Living Act, or something very similar in Mississippi, which lays out a process whereby states check their licenses, see if it's the most freeing way of regulating the occupation without so basically they're trying to make sure that the occupational concerns are taken care of without going too far in regulating.
And John, that seems to be really the kind of the nut of the debate here, because when you have professions, say, in the medical field, for example, one might think, yeah, it seems to make sense that someone should have to be licensed and have to meet strict knowledge requirements, training requirements, because the consequence of something going wrong if they aren't trained properly could be very, very serious, or in some cases even fatal. How do you determine then what industries really do legitimately need to have some sort of a state licensing role? How do you even go about looking at that?
Well, and that is the open question. And recently, it's been studied by the Council of State Governments. There's over 1,000 licenses, over like 1,100 different licenses, occupations that are licenses in different states.
1,100? It's hard to even realize that there are that many fields that could possibly be licensed.
But there are only about 60 that are licensed in all the states, which means that the vast majority of them, almost 95% of them, are not licensed in all the states, which means that states are in significant disagreement over whether this occupation or that rises to the level of licensing.
It almost sounds like states are making arbitrary decisions as to a whole list of things that they're going to require to be licensed.
It can seem like that, and I think that's a fair criticism. And sometimes it seems like if this particular occupation's got a strong enough lobby in that state.
John, based on the fact that we now have two pretty high-profile legal cases here in North Carolina, and we've talked about them both, you mentioned the U.S. Supreme Court decision related to the state's dental board and teeth whitening, and then also the makeup artistry question that we were talking about. One would think then that North Carolina policymakers would be looking at these decisions and saying, you know what, this is going against us. We need to reform our regime for how we license occupations.
Well, I know in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of discussion at the General Assembly about what to do regarding licensing in North Carolina, and nothing has come out. They've not passed anything yet, but there's been a lot of discussion, and that's one of the things that I want to do is provide as much information that I can that can hopefully inform these discussions and these debates.
What kind of guidelines would you suggest that policymakers follow when they're assessing these?
I mean, the top guideline is to leave the occupation free unless and until it can be decided that there is actually a significant reason for the state to get involved. But even so, the state doesn't have to go all the way into licensing. That's the most extreme way, because licensing is an entry regulation. It's a barrier to entry. So, for example, if you're worried about, I mean, first of all, courts have the first and foremost role in government. If you have a bad experience with a service professional, you can take them to court. If you're worried about fly-by-night providers, someone just showing up, I mean, you allow registration with the Secretary of State's office. If you're worried about insurance reimbursement, then you can have certification. If you're worried about cleanliness, for example, require inspections. None of those say you have to perform all of these things and jump through all of these hoops before you can even start your line of work.
John, it sounds like you're recommending that licensing, occupational licensing, really be the last resort, not
yes,
the first.
Absolutely.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.